The story is told, though who can say if it be true, of a clan of medieval warriors awoken in modern-day Manhattan, of the animated series that told their story.
It is an age of darkness. Superstition and the sword rule. It is an age of fear. It is the age of gargoyles.
Welcome to Voices from the Eerie, a Gargoyles podcast.
Welcome back, Gargoyles fans, to another episode of Voices from the Eerie, a Gargoyles podcast. I'm your co-host, Greg Bashansky, and joining me as usual is my partner in crime and back on camera for our Patreon supporters, Jennifer L. Anderson.
Hello, everyone.
And rejoining us, as usual, is the co-creator of the series, the supervising producer of the first two seasons, and the writer of the SLG and Dynamite comic books, Mr. Greg Wiseman.
Hi.
And we're very pleased to introduce the show for the very first time. He was credited as the sound dubbing supervisor on the series, Mark Vonderheide. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Excellent job.
All right. Well, we like to get to know our guests a little bit first. Sure. Mr. Vonderheide, or Mark, if you prefer.
Mark is fine.
This is an area of the business that I'm largely ignorant of. What does a sound dubbing supervisor do?
Well, I'll try to give you a short answer and then maybe a little longer one if you're interested. Sound is so important and often overlooked in making television and films. And a sound dubbing supervisor essentially is responsible for making sure that the sound mix gets done on time, that all the music, sound effects, and dialogue that are needed for that mix get recorded and put together and creatively chosen and cut into the show by editors, and then taken to a mix stage. And that's where I worked with Greg most closely on this series. And the mix stage is one of my favorite places to be because it's where you can tell the other side of the story from picture. Sound is used, when it's used well, in so many ways to enhance what the picture is, and it can even make picture do things that it didn't intend to do. And it can also be very subliminal in what you perceive, especially with music, which I think is the most obvious. When it's not dialogue driven, there's music. And when there's an opportunity for music to play, it gives you a clue into what mood you should be feeling. It makes you feel scared. It makes you feel emotional and happy, whatever the mood of that scene is. And then sound effects are also important. You can set a mood with sound effects that the audience may not even be aware of, that they're being sucked into the scene by the types of sound they're hearing, because we all process sound kind of unconsciously. And this is why I love sound, because it really does allow for a creative layer to help tell your story.
Excellent. And that is true. Not for the episode we're about to talk about any minute now, but two episodes ago when we talked about Shadows of the Past, Jennifer talked about how well the sound design in the episode was. I believe he especially pointed out how creepy it was when the stone gargoyles just disintegrated.
Just fell apart. That was... that whole scene in the cave, every little echo and the weird magic effects that were going on, just really stood out to me.
Well, that's great.
Really made the scene.
It was successful because that, it's kind of the unsung hero in a lot of ways. The people that do the editorial for music and sound, because if they do a good job, they're invisible. but what they do is so important in exactly the way you described. And the thing about animation, which makes it even, I think, more interesting and fun for the people who work on it, is that you're creating a world from scratch. There's no production. There's no sound that you recorded, as part of the live action shoot. So everything that you hear is created and creatively chosen for, maximum effect to make the story pop.
I'd say that without a doubt, the mix is my favorite part of the entire process. I mean, that's where it all really starts to feel like it's coming together. And generally speaking, it's like, oh, good, this episode's working. even when we're editing the show,
the final litmus test to see that it's finally going to be a good episode.
Yeah, it's not literally the final step, although it's close to it. That's the moment when I, you know, we get footage back. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes not so much. Often there's a mix of great footage and so-so footage. And sometimes you have to settle for something that isn't quite what you want it to be. But once you start to apply the sound to it in the mix, it starts to coalesce in a way that, generally speaking, maybe immodestly, I tend to be fond of my own shows, and it's the mix where it's finally like, okay, yes, I wasn't sure if this was working. Now I can see that it is. The first show I ever worked on post in, I'd attended a couple post sessions, but the first show I ever really worked in post on was Gargoyles. And so everything I know about doing a mix, I learned from Mark.
Oh, well, that was my first job at Disney, was working on your show. And I had just moved from New York. You asked me a little bit about myself, so I'll give you the abbreviated version. Yes. I had been working for a music production company as a music editor in New York. Edited music for every kind of programming there is. And I got into animation just because they got into animation. So I worked on a number of Disney shows, and my favorite show was The New Adventures of Mighty Mouse, which was a Ralph Bakshi show that we had the best time with music on that show. And I got to be the music editor on that show. And we were nominated for an Emmy for music direction and composition. So that was my first, that was in my 20s. I was nominated for an Emmy for the first and only time. But it was very exciting to work on a show that had, it had like a jazz soundtrack. And I got to, this is what we do in the industry to, because there's a budget issue, right, with music. It's these days more than there even was back then in the 90s, but you can't record new music for every episode. So what a music editor does is they take the music that's been recorded, they re-edit it into new ways and make it last longer and create the mood for the show that the composer would do. So it's like a tag team. And I got to do that. And that's how I really got into the music side of things. So when I came to Disney, I had left New York and moved out to LA in 93, and I got a job at Disney in 94, and Aladdin and Gargoyles were my first two shows. And I was the happiest person in the world because, one, they were both great shows, but Gargoyles especially was a treat because I just moved from New York and I got to see New York in the, you know, nation, and it made me feel less like I didn't know where the, you know, I was a fish out of water. So it was a wonderful experience. And Greg was so much fun on the dub stage. One, because you were so generous in offering people like myself an opportunity to help tell the story with sound. And you had a wonderful team of people at Advantage Audio who created, you know, we can talk about how the music was created, and Carl Johnson's score is incredible. I rewatched episode one after I was invited to hear, you know, to come and join you. And I swear I watched it and it was like I knew every single second of that show instantly. It all came back like it was yesterday that we did it, because it was such a joy to create a world for this series with sound and music. And the music is so iconic and it's, you know, it's just, it's so memorable. And that really helped bring the show to life. And the sound you mentioned, we worked really hard with Greg and the team at Advantage to come up with, what do the gargoyles sound like when they fly? What do their, you know, what does it sound like when they come to life? And how do you make that world that's sonically so interesting? How do you bring those characters to life? And they did an incredible job. So that's what made it such a joy to be on the dub stage, which I agree is my favorite place to be.
This is awesome. I mean, I attended film school. I didn't pursue the sound aspect, but I took an introduction to sound, which in that school anyway consisted of giving us cameras and sending us out with boomsticks into the middle of Sunset Boulevard at 9 o'clock at night. You'll be amazed what you encounter there. People who sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow better than Judy Garland did.
Oh, you can, you never know what you're going to experience.
That's
the side of it.
An interesting place to be.
My first movie that I ever saw, I'm going to age myself, but it's fine, in 5.1 Dolby was Raiders of the Lost Ark at the Ziegfeld Theater in New York. And that's the movie that made me say, I want to work in sound. Because hearing a Dolby Atmos mix where you're literally ducking down in your seat because gunfire in Tibet is going all around you. And I was like, there's people that do this for a living? I want to know them. I want to do this. So that was my inspiration to follow this path.
Very cool.
And a fantastic movie, too.
Yeah, I mean, that too. It still holds up. They still made a new one last year.
Oh my gosh.
So how do you think this aspect of the business has evolved over the years?
Well, I mentioned budgets. It's definitely gotten harder to get a budget for sound because it's sometimes the last thing that people think about. So music budgets have been cut. Music editors don't even really exist in the same way that they did, like the way that when I was doing it. Composers now have to work with keyboards and synthesizers and don't get a full orchestra. So it's definitely impacted the sonic palette in that way. Composers are expected to deliver score that's ready to air. If there's a music editor needed,
pre-edited,
they have to hire it themselves. So that's changed. We had such a, you know, being at Disney in the 90s was like hitting the jackpot because the first film I ever saw on a Disney lot screening was The Lion King. And I was like, oh my God, speaking of films that catch you from the moment they start. And I was like, I landed in the right place. And we had wonderful budgets. We had an orchestra for Aladdin, the series, and for Gargoyles. And that's changed in most instances, except for films that have that budget. For TV, it's certainly changed. So that's part of it. Technology has changed. It's possible to use technology in new creative ways to do sound design, to take dialogue that was recorded maybe not in under ideal circumstances like we've been doing. So currently I work on the show Bob's Burgers, which is also really fun.
Love it.
And we recorded dialogue all through COVID, and we had to record in people's homes and bathrooms and closets and God knows where. And the audio wasn't great, but we had no choice. That was the only way we could get it. And so the tools to make that audio, to enhance it, and the people that my engineers that I work with, who I rely on, and my editors are so talented about taking that material and finding programs that will enhance that and make it clean and sound better. We did the Bob's Burgers movie, and a lot of that was done during COVID. And so we had to clean up that dialogue, and that's a lot of work, and it's a skilled person that can do that work. So technology is helpful in that sense, but the overall craft of sound, I don't know that it's changed that much. I mean, you still, if you're lucky enough to work with really creative people, they still are old school, what I call old school, which is they go out and record. You know, I worked on Central Park, which is a show for Apple I did with the same group that does Bob's Burgers. And our mixer, Zach Martin, who was also our sound designer, he said he would go to New York and record. And he asked me one time when I went to New York, hey, what does it sound like on the northeast part of the park? Because this is where this scene takes place, and I don't want it to sound like the southwest part of the park. And I was like, okay, first of all, that's the craziest question a sound person has ever asked me, but sure, I'll go and I'll tell you how many horns I hear and how many cars. Like, so his craft, these people who do this work are artists, and they take it really seriously. And again, a lot of this work is invisible to people, but the way that they can take, I mean, let's talk about, you know, Jurassic Park and the dinosaurs and how animals were used and pitched down and combined together to create the sound of a dinosaur. Again, this work is fascinating to me. I could talk about it for the whole hour, so I'll stop. But I think these are artists that are often they're just invisible because people, if it's bad, you notice it. But if it's great, it just pulls you into the story. And it's so impressive what can be done with sound and music.
Agreed. And I've been rewatching the show, quote unquote, for the first time as we've been doing this podcast, because I've seen it many times across the almost 30 years now. But I try to watch it again with that fresh eye, and I listen to all the details. I watch it on my TV, then I watch it on my computer with my headphones on to listen to the sound also. So I'm really glad to have you here, and I'm picking up on little beats and little sound effects at times that sometimes I wouldn't even notice, but when I'm listening for them, there they are. And
yeah, often it's on that second watch where you're not it's a different experience than watching something the first time, where you're hopefully absorbed in the story and you're not. So I can always tell if I'm, because I'm, it's hard for me in the business and to watch something and not analyze it, right? Because it's what I do for a living. But when I'm not analyzing something, I know that's, it's good, because it, something isn't pulling me out. So it's interesting. But when you watch it the second time, after you've experienced it, you know what's coming, so you have a different perspective. I think that's fun, because then you do exactly what you said. You hear all the work that goes into it, and like, oh, listen to that cat that I heard off screen, and then later, you know, it showed up, or listen to the police siren that told me that there was going to be police action later on in the show. Or there's all these things that sound designers do that are just little, you know, Easter eggs for you to find.
When I rewatched this episode, and I wasn't, you guys already know that I listen for things when I'm watching shows, but for the first time ever, I'm like watching it, and I'm kind of not watching it because I'm doing this at work. Shh.
You guys realize we're recording this, right? I mean, like, your
employers... Let me tell you, I told my boss, but okay. I was also still getting work done.
Okay.
But I was like, for the first time ever, it dawned on me you could hear the clock in the clock tower. I never noticed that before. And I'm like, now I'm going to have to go watch the whole thing all over again. But no, like, great. Little details like that, that like for 30 years, I never noticed.
But somehow it made it feel more real to you.
Yeah.
Because that was in there.
Mark and I went to lunch just the other day, and we talked about how one thing that's changed is that some of the training that we all had back in the day in a mix, to me, and I think Mark would agree, you know, the first rule is dialogue always wins, because you're mixing dialogue, music, sound effects, Foley effects, all sorts of stuff in there. But the rule was always dialogue always wins. If we bothered to record an actor saying something in a cartoon, then, you know, we weren't doing that for nothing. That always comes first. And I found watching stuff recently, and granted, I'm really old now and my hearing isn't what it used to be, but still I'm amazed at how, you know, things are mixed these days, where they get really excited about some big explosion effect and they've done all this complex work and it's admirable on one level, but they've got someone speaking and you cannot hear what they're saying. And to me, being, as Mark said, old school, it's literally bizarre to me that the attention to rule one seems to have been lost to a great extent in a lot of stuff that I'm watching these days.
It's one of the reasons, you know, I just keep the closed captioning on all the time.
We were talking about that too.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much that gets lost that
drives my wife crazy. But yeah, like,
why am I rewinding this? I'll just read it.
Yeah, it's, you know, the one of the...
But I don't... But the thing is, I turn it off for Gargoyles. I don't need it for Gargoyles.
Because you know it so well.
Well, there's that, but also because I can hear it.
Well, fair, yeah.
Literally, yeah.
The mix was good. Good.
The mix was good. And we paid attention to rule one, and I don't need it.
Right.
So it's an odd sort of phenomenon that I've noticed in the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, something like that, that's a difference I've noticed. And the difference with the music is, as Mark said, is that, you know, no budgets for a full orchestra, no budget for a music editor. But one thing that has changed, I guess you could say positively, is that back in the day on Gargoyles, I know we've talked about this before when Carl was on the show, you know, we would after the first couple episodes or so, maybe three, we would select cues, new original cues for Carl to do. But otherwise, our music editor, Mark Perlman, was this huge hero on the show who would take from our library of cues and score the thing. He was really scoring it because we didn't have the budget for Carl to score every scene, every sequence from every episode. So Carl would do a handful of things. And then Mark had to use the library. Well, one thing that's changed now is that composers on shows are composing top to bottom for the entire episode. I'm not saying they're not reusing cues. Of course they are, but they are scoring everything to picture. They're not using a full orchestra, but we're getting more specificity, I guess I'd say, than we used to, because they are scoring the entire episode the way you'd score an entire movie, you know.
And one or two people with, you know, the technology and maybe bringing in a few instruments to accentuate like what you're doing in an electronic world.
Right. Like Spectacular Spider-Man, it was all electronic except for the guitar. And then they had Greg Herzenot come in and play guitar because we wanted guitar to be a major element of the Spidey score. But all the rest of it was electronic except for the guitar, no matter how bizarre or specific the instrumentation was, it was all pretty much electronic except for the guitar work.
There's some instruments that you just need a human being to play. They don't
sound
the same. And that'll never change. You know, remember when synthesizers came out and everyone was like, oh, that's it. No more orchestras. We're never going to have musicians anymore. Just one person's going to replace everybody. And it never happened because there's, you know, the best way to use that technology is to use it as a tool, as part of your toolbox, and enhance it with real human beings. But yeah, Mark Perlman was amazing. Mark Perlman did the job that I was describing that I did before. So I knew exactly what he was being asked to do and how hard it was. And we'd sit there and we would do spotting sessions, and then we'd listen to what he did and we'd make changes. And the thing I noticed after watching the few episodes I watched, you know, rewatched, we used a lot of music, you know, and it really works. It was so good. Like, you wanted to score scenes, and a lot of that work, you can hear it in this particular episode we're going to talk about, because there's a lot of gunfire and a lot of battle scenes and, you know, lots of different moods in this episode. And it's challenging to take a piece of music, and I'm saying this from my own experience because I did it, and create a new mood or a new series of moods and make it sound, the goal is to make it sound like somebody did compose it and played it. And it's not, you don't hear edits, right? You're not going to, then we failed as music editors. But in success, we're invisible because we recreated a scored scene that feels like it was scored by the composer. And of course, as a music editor, the last thing you want is the composer to call you and say, what the hell are you doing? You know, that's my reputation that you're screwing with. So there was a lot of care, of course, from myself and from Mark, because we knew what Carl would have written, you know, like we heard the episodes he scored and we wanted them all to sound like they had an orchestra and scored them all. And, you know, we were smart. And I think, you know, Greg reminded me of something we did where we would look ahead in the story and say, oh, there's these very specific cues that we need for this particular character or this particular scene that's being introduced later in the season. And we saved money and saved time and recorded those things so that we wouldn't have to try to make them work when they were going to fall outside of the wheelhouse of what the score was that we had. And that was really important, I think, to the success of it.
Big example of that was Macbeth's theme, which made use of bagpipes and things that we obviously didn't have as a standard element of our score to give it that one comes to mind. There were others. Episodes were coming up on like Mark of the Panther. We did some stuff for that, I think. But where we felt like what we were going to be doing was going to fall outside the realm of what Carl had already scored. We'd save up a little bucks and do some stuff for that. But the early season one, the big example was Macbeth, where we knew when we introduced that character, we'd want to give a little more bang for the buck, so to speak, and make him specific and unique. And then, of course, we had that so that when Macbeth reappeared in season two, we had Macbeth's stuff that was sort of signature to him.
All right. This has all been very fantastic. I think it's about time to transition into discussing the episode, though, Kingdom, which is a really fun episode and really nice to check back in to Manhattan after up until this point, 5-episode absence. The absence is going to get longer after this, but no, it was just really fun to check in with them. And as I recall, this episode also originally aired much later in the sequence, and I don't think that particularly works. I think it had to be here because with Monsters next and then Gollum following it up. I mean, after Monsters, you would think Bruno would have debriefed Xanatos in the situation. And after Gollum, that Renard would have gotten word of some kind back.
Yeah, I mean, we had a couple episodes. This was one. I think the other one was we've already covered the price. But those were the two episodes that had to air out of order because we had, you know, our tentpole episodes and our tiers. And we had made the agreement after the sort of big mess that Enric Beth caused in season one, where we really couldn't air that episode out of order, that between the tentpoles, those episodes, if necessary, could air in any order. We didn't quite manage that, you know, with things like Owen's Stone Hand in The Price and him getting the Stone Hand and that episode airing too soon when there were other episodes when he didn't have the Stone Hand yet that aired afterwards. And here, this one aired too late after some of the news of what was going on with Goliath and Elisa and Bronx would have gotten back to our home cast. And, you know, I think given the fact that we did 52 episodes on a 10-month sliding schedule, we did pretty well in terms of airing episodes in order. But this one aired a little late originally. And that's because other episodes were ready first. And we couldn't justify holding all these episodes up for this one. Particularly since we had promised they were all airable in any order within the tier. And we were kind of wrong. I mean, we didn't quite manage it, but
so close.
So close. I don't think it was really damaging to have this one out of order. It still got the idea across of, hey, we're missing these people. Where are they? We don't know. It just would have been better if it had come up where we're slotting it here than the way, for example, Disney Plus has it. They've still got it in the wrong order on Disney Plus, which is
especially
really bothers me, but what can I do?
Especially for poor Cagney, who in the Disney Plus order would have been starving by this point. So,
thank you for not forgetting Cagney.
Yes.
No, never forget Cagney. Cagney has a pretty big role in this episode. This is sort of a big episode for Cagney.
Lots of purring.
And Greg just
glossed
over something that's important for those who don't work in animation. You just casually mentioned our schedule, our animation schedule. It was very aggressive. And it meant that this wasn't my area, but it impacted us because when we couldn't get a locked picture, which means we couldn't, you know, if something was happening and things were a locked picture means they've stopped editing it and it's not going to change anymore. And if you want to know, sliding back to your other question, what's changed in the business? The word locked doesn't mean anything anymore. Nothing ever gets locked.
Anything can change at any time.
Correct. And that's a big challenge for sound and music who are trying to work to a picture that's actually going to be the one that's finished. So there were a lot of things that had to be moved around just from logistics that, you know, impacted creative calls because shows came back and footage needed to go back for retakes. And things that just made it not possible to finish it on the original schedule. So there were a lot of sliding around, and I was joking with Greg at lunch about a particular scenario where we mixed episodes out of sequence. And I was a fan. Like, this was the first anthology show I worked on as far as animation. It's not typical that there's an anthology element to it. And we mix a show out of sequence, and I think
you mean serialized element.
Serialized, yeah, yeah. That's yeah. Serialized, that it takes place, you know, with, it's not just like Bob's Burgers is, they never age, they nothing ever happens. By the end of the episode, everything's back the way it was, you know. That's the way animation is typically done. And this was a series that had a continuing story. And we mixed one out of sequence, and I was completely lost. And I just turned to Greg, and I was like, wait a minute, what's happening? And he just looked at me and smiled, so you'll have to wait and see, you know, because he didn't want to ruin it for me. But it was funny because I
or because I'm a son of a bitch.
You had a great smile when you said, you know, because I was watching as a fan, even when I was working on the show. And I was invested in the story, and I didn't know what happened because I don't remember the instance, but some character did something. And I'm like, wait a minute. And it was just, I had to wait till we mixed that one to find out how that we got there.
Nice. This is mostly Brooklyn's episode, but we'll get to him later. We purposely, for our last Mutate episode, neglected to talk about Fang because we knew this episode was coming up. And this is really where we get to know Fang, for better or for worse, and Jim Belushi's performance as Fang. Jen, what are your thoughts on Fang and Jim Belushi's performance?
He's freaking brilliant. And like every time I watch this, like there's like three different times he goes, give me that. And I love it every time he does it. Take something away from someone. Give me that. Fang just Jim is larger than life. So much fun.
Jim is so fun in the booth. I mean, just was always a kick. Just gave us great, rich stuff. And, you know, Fang is an over-the-top character, no doubt about it, but he makes it real. And it was so good that when we, Gary Sperling and I were developing the Bad Guys spinoff series, I was like, we gotta have Fang in this. He's just too much fun. We need that
so
humor,
much
and we need
quipping
that
and snark involved with Fang.
And you know, he's callow and all sorts of, you know, wondrous negative traits that he still manages to make fun. And that's a credit to Jim and to Jamie. Who really, but don't tell him I said this, is a fantastic voice director, just a really great, but you know, we don't want it to go to his head. It's big enough already, really. Right. Fills the whole square, you know. I mean, it just
I love him.
Don't tell him. But but no, Jamie's fantastic, and Jamie gets such great stuff out of, I mean, there's a reason that I worked with Jamie for 30 years. I can't remember what it is, but I'm sure there's a reason. So, you know, he always manages to get terrific stuff, but it also goes back to great dialogue written by Marty Eisenberg and Bob Skurr. And Gary story editing that, and then Jim performing it and Jamie directing it. We wind up with just great stuff on Fang. But he is just a really just fun character to let loose.
And he just pokes all the bears.
It's true. I don't like to ask questions, but I'm just curious because I never asked them. How did your casting experience go? How did you decide what voice should play these characters?
Well, so we had two different processes. One was for the regulars. The original season one regulars were obviously Goliath, Elisa, Brooklyn Lexing Broadway, in theory, Bronx, but only two guys auditioned for Bronx. It was Frank Welker and Jim Cummings. And even as Jim was auditioning for Bronx, he's like, I know Frank is getting this. And then Xanatos and Demona and everyone else, until we got to Angela, who we also held auditions for, but every other character, as far as I can recall, we just cast. Some combination of me, Jamie, and Frank would sit down. Sometimes Michael Reeves, particularly in season one, but occasionally other times, might toss in a suggestion. But mostly it was Jamie, Frank, and I sort of sitting there going, okay, usually in the booth, you know, while we were on a break in the middle of a recording, going, okay, what are we going to need coming up? And we'd, you know, talk about the characters that were coming up and say who might play them. And, you know, sometimes we'd make some suggestions and the people wouldn't be available or we couldn't get them for one reason or another. We had a pretty strict rule about paying scale plus 10% for everybody, because everyone had a favored nation clause in Disney, which what that means is that if you give someone a boost, you've got to give everyone a boost. And I don't think this will come as a shock, certainly not to Mark or Jennifer. but a company like Disney doesn't want to give anybody a boost. So they, you know, if they're not willing to come in for scale plus 10, it's tough to get them. There would be limitations sometimes because someone's quote was higher or just because they weren't available, particularly in those days. We really wanted, at least for the first recording, certainly to have the person in the booth with the whole cast playing off the whole cast. So, you know, you might find someone who's available generally, but not available on the day of our record. And nowadays, certainly post pandemic, everyone records whenever with different, you know, often again from their kid's bunk bed or something like that with blankets.
Closets
down
and
to,
yeah,
you know.
And yeah, pictures of everybody's home closets and setups so that we could publish a book.
Right. Yeah. But back then, everyone, you know, came in and we took that for granted. I miss that now. I want to get back to full group recordings. I think that, you know, some of the stuff we did during the pandemic for Young Justice, I think it all turned out great. I'm not upset about it, but I think there's something lost by not having the actors being able to react off each other in the room.
100%.
Yeah.
Being on Bob's Burgers, which is a show that also recorded ensemble for the first 10 years, and then we had to stop, and we're now doing it again. And yes, it's instantly the energy of the cast and of the records it's like an adrenaline boost. It's incredible what a difference it makes.
I agree. So that was an important factor in there as well. So there were limitations, but generally speaking, you know, Jamie and I, again, sometimes with Frank, would be in the booth and it'd be like, okay, we've got to record Fang, and Fang had one line of dialogue in a prior episode that we had had Jonathan Frakes, who played Xanatos. We didn't want to bring in a whole actor for one line. So we had Jonathan sort of play it, that one line under his breath so that it didn't feel like the audience would lock in on that voice too much. But now we're like, okay, now he's going to have a bigger part. I don't think this was this wasn't Fang's first episode. This was
his second,
like his
third, but
Jim's second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jim's second.
Right. So, but for that, for his first real substantial appearance, that was when we would have cast Jim. And then it's sort of like, okay, this guy, he's got some attitude, you know, talent. Maggie is desperate to get back to being a human. Talon, is sort of this noble fallen hero, but we want one guy in this group who likes what's happened to him, who likes the superpowers he's got and being able to fly, being able to generate electricity, who doesn't want to go back to being human. So who would have that kind of attitude? And, you know, 30 years out, I have no memory of who suggested Jim initially. My guess is that it's Jamie. Again, don't tell him that I'm praising him, but,
I'm going to text him right now.
That's why.
Don't do that.
That's why I asked the question, because, you know, the casting on the show is just incredible. It really, the character is, it's clear that there was thought put into how to bring it to life.
It really was. I mean, we got lucky sometimes where we tried someone out and, oh my God, they're great, you know, and other times, you know, we had with Jim, we had a pretty good idea of what he could do, but it was that mesh of character with performer that just worked out perfectly. And, you know, it whether it's Tim Curry playing Savarius or Rocky Carroll in this episode, I mean, Rocky, from my point of view, was a huge find, who did so much great work for us as Derek and Talon, but also was terrific as Glasses. Took a really minor character and really helped make that character stand out as unique. In this episode, he plays Al, the homeless guy, also Rocky does. And in just one or two lines of dialogue, you know, helps that character to pop. But yeah, you know, when we're on the run on this kind of schedule, we don't have time to hold auditions for, you know, three or four characters per episode. There's no way. So you're just, you know, picking your shots and going, let's go for it. And we were, you know, 95% of the time just, you know, smart or lucky or some combination of both. And we'd wind up with this absolutely phenomenal cast. There's so much fun in this episode with Jim, but like, you know, Jeff Bennett is Lou, one of Fang's henchmen. It's got some great stuff there. I think I'm not sure. Is that Tom Wilson as Chaz? I think it is, but I wasn't too sure. Chaz only has one line, but Lou's got a bunch of stuff. And Jeff, who's already playing Owen and Brooklyn in the episode, you know, just does this great character bit as Lou in there. That's so much fun. And, you know, we just had a great cast to work with to begin with. And then we just were able to bring in some great guest stars all the time. And Ed, of course, Asner, is just so wonderful in this episode as he not so subtly manipulates Brooklyn into doing what he should
There's
be doing.
There's a lot of day one. People manipulating other people in this episode. That's like a lot of that going on. But
and very, you know, I don't know, with very few lines of dialogue, but you get it. You know, it's like, okay.
Well, Talon's fairly easy to manipulate, let's be honest.
Talon is so a Mazza in this episode. Like, oh my gosh, something's wrong. It must be Xanatos. Barge in. Like, it's just a very Elisa thing, you know, early Elisa thing.
I'll admit, in their shoes, that's who I probably would have blamed at this point also, which is a good thing why Brooklyn was second in command and became leader and not me. So, But no, I really love the arcs in this. This is about leadership. You've got Fang, who wants to be leader, but is clearly not qualified. Talon, who is already the leader, but doesn't want to recognize that he's a leader. And Brooklyn, who is trying very hard not to be a leader at all.
And that makes sense.
And Hudson, who is the old leader, shoving the new leader into his role.
Yeah. So. Then there's that line at the end where they say, I guess we're both going to be leaders.
Yeah, they come to terms with it. They're all better off with these two in charge.
Right. It's really interesting because it is, watching it again, it's a self-contained episode of sorts in its story, where it starts and where it ends. It's still part of the larger story, but it's a it's a fun episode of, wait, well, you know, new information a little bit, but just the, you know, good versus evil, essentially.
One good versus obnoxious, in any case.
Yeah. I mean, Fang's a crook, but he's a petty crook. But I love how in this show, not every villain needs to be a Xanatos or a Demona or a Thalug or an Archmage. You can have this petty rook take command of the in the antagonistic role in the episode, and it works.
Yeah. I mean, we wanted to play with a lot of different flavors in the show. Xanatos and Demona are both big villains, but they have very different flavors, very different styles. It's not that there isn't some overlap. There is certainly here and there, but obviously you're not going to, you couldn't just slot Xanatos into a Demona episode or vice versa. And so, you know, we felt that we had the room in the show, the breath, so to speak, to do a Drakon episode, do a Fang episode. They didn't all have to be Shredder. Not that I'm down on Turtles, but you know, you didn't need it to be the same person in every episode. We had the room and we had the breadth of cast, not just of actors, but of characters that would allow us to do something different this time.
A lot of little fun moments. Jen, what did you think of this? I know I loved it. Owen making use of his stone fist. It's a small moment, but I love it.
I mean, come on. He's resourceful.
The bit that doesn't work for me in hindsight, and it may have been my idea for all I recall, but is the security cannons. Let's test those security cannons. And I was watching the episode last night with my daughter, who is 29 now but hadn't seen it in quite some time, and I'm like, well, that's a successful test in the sense that you tested it and found out it's a really bad idea, because the only thing that's getting blown up is your own damn castle. That is not a good security system.
That's really not. It's like there's got to be like some sort of you know, fail safe. Got... like if it's pointing at itself, it needs to not fire.
Right. He clearly went to the same store Macbeth went to when he bought those cannons for his. And I'm like, wow, we were really, really unoriginal here. I mean, I know we needed some action and we needed some stuff there, but I'm like, that was the best we could come up with. last night I'm watching it. I'm like going, this is Owen should be embarrassed. That's where I'm going to land. Instead of saying I should be embarrassed, I'm going to land with Owen should be embarrassed for choosing that security system. But I have to say, the banter between Owen and Xanatos in the scene that follows that, when all the when Talon and the trio come in to confront him, that's some of the best Xanatos lines ever. Do I really need an excuse to have a good time in my own home?
You know, that line in real life all the time. All the time. I love it.
That is such a great line in that context. And even Owen gets in on the act. Like there is Owen, who's usually so just functional here, even he's got a smart ass remark that puts the four of them in their place. And I just thought all that stuff that almost made those dumbass cannons worthwhile, because all the dialogue that followed is so sharp. And again, you know, credit to that, to Marty, Bob and Gary, but I just thought that that's great stuff, as opposed to the cannons, which were not
great. Not so great.
Not one of our best moments with those cannons.
I watched it wondering what happens to all the damage that filters down to the street. That's what I thought.
I mean, later in one of the SLG comics, I give Owen this line where he is, I guess, I can't remember the exact line, but it was something along the lines of he's exhausted whatever amusement he gets from repairing the damage to the castle from all the various stuff that's gone on there. Because I'm like, yeah, that's That's gotten old. I think blowing up chunks of the castle. Let's try and get past that because we've played that often enough.
Speaking of great stuff, Claw in this episode. Jen, what do you think of Claw in this episode?
I love Claw. I love Claw so much. And, you know, and I kudos to putting a character in there that has no lines and still getting story out of it.
He's it's still a defining episode for Claw.
He's just so much a part of the episode and doesn't say a word. And he's pantomiming and he's reacting. And I just, he just deserves critches. he's such a good kitty.
Especially since, let's be honest, this is not one of the better looking episodes of the show. The Mutate episodes have been, unfortunately, not been the best animated at all, but they got a lot of really great acting out of Claw.
I think this is a really good one for Claw.
Yeah. I mean, it really sort of, this was the first one that for Claw really defined his character, I think, in a way. Like Fang, we had met before. We hadn't seen how far he was willing to go. But Claw, you know, because he's mute.
The strong, silent type.
Yeah, we weren't too sure what to make of him before. And now we get the sense that he's the biggest one, biggest mutate. But he is not a fighter and he gets afraid. And Fang intimidated him and sort of pushed him into doing things he didn't want to do. And then he ultimately makes a decision. Whose side he's going to be on and makes a choice. And that was, and you know, he makes a choice, a sort of clandestine in the middle of the episode, but at the, by the end, he's made an overt decision to be a good guy. But one of the things that was sort of, that we talked about a lot, even at the time, was that we had a lot of warriors on the show. And that included Talon, and I guess to a certain extent, Fang. But we decided that it was okay that we had a couple mutates on the show that were not warriors. And just because they had big-time superpowers, Maggie and Claw were not going to be warriors. And so when Maggie makes the decision, when Claw frees Maggie, lets her loose, I think the assumption is she's going to get into that fight, but that's not at all what she does. She goes to get help. And for us, that was kind of an important lesson for kids because kids should not be getting into dangerous situations. They should go get help. And part of me was like, is this a problem that, you know, the one female mutate we have isn't getting into the action? I thought, you know, this is not a show where we're light on female warriors. We've got Damona, we've got Elisa, now we've got Angela. I don't think we had, you know,
It was already years later established that she's not, like, right. She's been timid from the first moment we see her. It would be odd to see her step up and be a big bad warrior now.
Right. I mean, I do think she comes into her own a bit in this episode. But that doesn't mean as a warrior, she comes into her own as a sort of co-leader. And also I thought as an actress, you know, one of my headcanons for Maggie is that she'd come to New York originally before Savarius found her as a, you know, young struggling actress who never got a role and then ran out of money and then found herself homeless and found herself in Savarius's clutches. Way back when, right? Now we actually get to see her act and she's really good.
I love
Pat, like, Susie is really good, but Maggie actually has this really great acting moment in the in the episode that I really liked a lot.
And I love as she swipes that card and she just keeps going and she's just like cool as a cucumber.
No, the facial expressions in this episode are terrific. I mean, especially Talon's when he comes out of that gun casing, which they were using as a makeshift prison. I mean, you don't want to be claustrophobic and trapped in that thing, I'm sure, but...
Nope. But...
like getting an MRI.
Yeah, but it had windows. Come on, it had windows.
Windows, but it can... I thought it was... I liked it because it contained the electricity that they gave off. They kept shooting at it when they tried to break into it, and it just bounced off. So we thought, well, that'll work from the inside too. So there's that great scene where Talon tries to use his electricity to get out of it, but and just winds up shocking himself. And so it's like, you know, it's unpleasant, but it's effective. You know, I don't know how they're going to feed him or if they plan on feeding him or anything ever. But so, yeah, not a pleasant little prison cell, but effective.
I like when they're trying to put Fang into it at the end, and he's like, grabbing a hold of everything, like anything to keep from going into the thing.
Right.
We won't talk about this till later when we get to bad guys, but considering the whole twisted Oliver Twist thing with the with all the homeless people in Labyrinth, I see why he chose the name Fred Sykes for the guy. So later in Bad Guys. But I also like the decision to turn the Labyrinth into this sanctuary for the homeless.
Yeah, I don't know that it's a particularly original idea, but we like the idea that we had this big set from the pilot of this underground facility that Cyberbiotics had abandoned because Hudson had basically trashed the place, or the battle had trashed the place. And so Cyberbiotics, having lost a whole bunch of money, had to, and wanting to get Fortress 2 up into the air, they had to
cut their losses,
divest in something. So one of the things they divested in was this underground laboratory. So the idea that, okay, we've got a place here, and, you know, we planned it. There's the episode where Savarius is kidnapped by Goliath, and he's stuck down there as a place to work. And so once Savarius and Xanatos, once Xanatos takes Savarius out of there, that's left as a place for Talon, Maggie, Claw, and Fang. And then the idea that over time, homeless people find it and find a relatively benign leadership situation there. And so it becomes sort of a place for misfits and outsiders, people that society sort of left behind in more ways than one. And that was a very conscious thing that we built throughout. I mean, it was influenced by, one of the influences for that was in the X-Men titles, the Morlocks.
That's immediately what I thought when.
Yeah. And that was definitely an influence on it. You know, we tried to make it our own, so to speak. And it, you know, it plays out well in a couple episodes in season two. And then I've also obviously made use of it in both the SLG and the Dynamite comics, because it's just a great sort of setting. And this idea, I think, which is obviously tied to the title, that under, you know, that there's this under kingdom, you know, just as the gargoyles sort of have this kingdom in the sky above the humans, the mutates sort of have this kingdom below the humans. And that sort of parallel between Brooklyn having to take leadership on high and Talon needing to take leadership below, that was very conscious and thematic. I'm not a big theme guy anymore. That kind of annoys me. But as my current bosses are learning. But back then I was big on theme because I'd been in executives, and executives are taught theme all the time. And so that for me was a big thematic element to this episode.
All right. The big discussion topic of the episode, Brooklyn's arc. Jennifer, what do you think of what Brooklyn's journey throughout this episode?
The reluctant leader. I my favorite Brooklyn moment in this whole thing is after they go in and confront Xanatos, and now Xanatos knows that Elisa and Goliath are missing, and he's just like, great, wonderful, as he like walks out at the whole thing. Like he knew it was going to happen and it happened and he is annoyed. But if he had stepped up and he'd put his foot down and said, let's not do that, then it wouldn't be there. It was a growing one for Brooklyn. Like, I feel like he didn't want to acknowledge Goliath being gone. He didn't want to face that reality. And him stepping up as the leader made him face that, that reality that they don't know where they are. He grew a lot this episode. He learned a lot, grew a lot, I think.
He did. I remember at one of the gatherings, I think it was the one in Williamsburg, they had a marathon of a fan voted top 10 episodes of the series, and this happened to be one of them. And I think when we had a discussion about that, we agreed it was because of Brooklyn's arc throughout this, and he's one of the most popular characters in the series for good reason.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's an interesting, to me, it was an interesting sort of transition, because in Upgrade, you know, everyone's fighting to be the leader until
he gets it.
Gets it. At which point he's suddenly like, whoa, wait a minute. What was I just trying to get? And now here you have all these, you know, mixed feelings. I mean, I think part of it is that he doesn't want to give up on Goliath. And somehow I think he feels that if he takes leadership, it's like a betrayal, you know, like, if I acknowledge myself as leader, it's like I'm giving up on Goliath's return, which of course is not the case, but that's part of the mess in his head.
And that's trying to push him through too.
Yeah. And then I think the other part is just like, oh my God, this is a lot of responsibility. I don't want this responsibility. Why did I ever think I wanted this responsibility? This is horrible. Stop. So that becomes a sort of fun, well, fun's the wrong word for him, but for us, kind of transition from the enthusiastic kid who thinks this is what he wants to the responsible adult who has to live with it. Hudson's clever, you know. It's like, I'm going to go see that Maggie. Oh, Maggie? I'll go see Maggie, sure. You know. So Hudson gets him to do the right thing for the wrong reason, but it gets him going at least. And that's something. And you know, as an individual, not about leading, but like when he's on his own, you know, he doesn't hesitate to intervene to help Al, the homeless guy. When it just comes to being a hero, that he knows, that he's fine with. It's about taking the responsibility of telling Hudson what to do. Hudson, of all people, let alone, you know, Lex and Broadway, or, you know, Cagney, or Talon, who, you know, is a pseudo leader in his own right there. It's like, if Talon is assertive, Brooklyn's not ready to sort of say, yeah, that's wrong, even though he sure knows it is. He's not ready for that at the beginning, but, you know, he gets there.
I love Hudson's line. Is that an order then?
Like, just goading him, like, this right, is like, what you need to be doing.
You know, Ed Asner's performance in this episode is just
fantastic.
I mean, he doesn't have a lot of lines, but he gets every inch out of every word.
He often
does. And he's crucial to the episode. Yeah. Like, yeah. I haven't seen or heard a bad Ed performance ever, I don't think so.
I had the opportunity to work with him, I think, one of the last times he worked, sadly. He played a character for us on Central Park. He was Stanley Tucci, who played Bitsy. He was Bitsy's brother. So they were this rich, you know, boy and girl grown up, and he was an older man, and we brought him into the studio, and you know, it was just wonderful to be in the room with him after his career and hear him act. And it was just sad when he passed, but just every performance. And plus, I understand from people who know him that he was an amazing human being as well.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Never had the pleasure. But Brooklyn's character arc, on a personal note also, this is the first time I've seen the episode in a while, and it's also the first time I've seen it since the first time in my career I ever entered a management position and I had to lead other people. And let me tell you, the growing pains of that for the very first time, it took a while. And Jen knows some of this stuff. I vented about my dates over the last year to her. She knows. But watching Brooklyn go through this, I'm like, yeah, I know how you feel, buddy. I know how you feel. So, but no, he did it wonderfully. Jeff Bennett's performance throughout the episode, and as all of the characters, especially Brooklyn, was terrific. And I just really enjoy this arc. There's a reason why this character captured the imagination of so many fans, so many Brooklyn fangirls, as we have known for a long time, and some fanboys.
oh, definitely the fanboys too. I got Matt Bluestone. You know how I love my Matt Bluestone.
And he was in this episode.
I got my Matt Bluestone. And the most hysterical opening of the drapes ever. That was a nice entrance by Broadway.
Aaron, my daughter, watching it last night, actually gasped out loud. Like when the drapes opened and Broadway was there, I was like, there's something really odd about that animation. In that one sequence, I don't know if they subcontracted that sequence, it's, you know, so long ago, it's lost to me, but there's something, I'm not even saying it's bad. It's not bad per se, but there's something different about it. And I can't quite put my finger on what it is about that sequence that is so strange. And Matt's a little off model, not too bad. Broadway's on model for the most part. So it's not that.
Love of my life, but Matt Bluestone looked amazing.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go.
To our audience, wait till we get to Jason Canmore.
Oh, go, shh, shh, shh. God, you know all my weaknesses.
But yeah, there's something odd about that sequence that I can't quite put my finger on visually, but it works. You know, it's a great little scene between the two of them. And the fact that they've sort of become buddies, I also like, you know, that since Matt's learned about the gargoyles, that he and Broadway have kind of bonded over their sort of shared love of detective fiction and conspiracy theories and stuff like that. And so I like that. I like, again, all the stuff with Cagney, Broadway bringing her over, and then Hudson sort of petting her. And then I think it's just funny when she's sleeping on
his head.
And then he wakes up and he does not like that. That does not go over well for Cagney.
Let's be honest. Brooklyn may have taken charge, but Cagney's going to be running the clock tower during the entire duration. That's his house now.
Love it.
All right. Mark, do you have any comments on any of the sound design or any other aspects of this episode that you may have worked on?
Yeah, I mean, I think the battle scenes are always fun for the sound designers because they get to do, you know, they get to get cannons, shoot at each other and knock down parts of the castle. So this one is pretty traditional. I listened through it, seeing if there was anything that was specifically unique about it. I think it's just a continuation of the atmosphere. And like Greg's pointing out, sound designers will try to find a way to make that, you know, the gargoyles world at the top of the castle sound different than the world below deck, so to speak, you know, in the abandoned areas. There's a conscious effort to subliminally tell you that you're moving from one, you know, world to another. And I did notice that that was present in this episode. And of course, you know, whenever anyone's firing something, sound designers love to make things explode and make guns sound. And especially then the electricity as well. So there was a lot of fun, I could tell, for the sound team on this one because of all the different ways that things exploded, blew up, or were electric.
Nice. Do we have any other points out of this episode? Jen, do you have any?
I think I got it all.
Right. Greg, do you have any?
I kind of regret that we never were able to wedge in paying off that notion of what does Xanatos do when he's learned that Goliath and Elisa are missing. You know, that bit of information is really intriguing in this episode, and we never, belatedly, like after the series was over, thought of a good story idea for that. But, you know, by that time we were so far past it that maybe it'll be a flashback story someday. But I do sort of regret that we never quite found a great story for that back in the day to pay off this really intriguing notion of Xanatos finding it out. What can he do with that information? And Brooklyn going, yeah, this is, I mean, as we discussed earlier, like, this is not good. So again, you know, there are little regrets here and there. I generally speaking, love the episode, but I regret that. And I regret those cannons. But but otherwise, you know, it's a fun one for me. And it was great to go back to the trio and Hudson. Before we jump back into Goliath, Angela, Elisa, and Bronx on the tour. So this was good.
All right. This is going to come out on April 12th. Does anybody have anything they would like to plug? Mark?
No, I don't. I'm watch Bob's Burgers and the Great North, the two shows that I work on, which have some new episodes coming, but strike interrupted some of that, but there'll be some new ones sporadically, and they're both really fun shows.
Well, for me, if you don't have them already, pick up all of Here in Manhattan is out by now, 12 issues. All of Gargoyle's Dark Ages is out by now, 6 issues. The first trade that collects the first 6 issues of Here in Manhattan, Gargoyles 1-6, is out by now. Mid-April is Quest out yet?
The 17th.
Okay, so we're not quite there when this comes out, but close to the first issue of Gargoyle's Quest, which is looking pretty fantastic to me. I saw the finished pages today, and I'm very happy. March, April, I think Spectacular Spider-Man number 2 should be out by now. Certainly number 1's was out in March, but I think 2 is out by mid-April. So pick that up. And then conventions appearances, I will be at Comic-Con Revolution in Ontario, California on May 18th for a Star Wars Rebels panel with all the regular cast, Taylor Gray, Tia Sirkar, Vanessa Marshall, Freddie Prinz, Dee Bradley Baker, I think is going to be there. I may be forgetting someone, but so we're having a Rebels panel there, which I think will be fun. And then I'm wearing the t-shirt. This is Convergence for the Gargoyles 30th anniversary. This was a shirt drawn by Chris Jones, our friend Chris Jones. And July 4th weekend in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of Gargoyles. I'll be there. Tom Adcox, the voice of Lexington, will be there. Bridget Bacco, the voice of Angela, will be there. Keith David, the voice of Goliath, will be there. Zara Fuzzle, the voice of Sherry, will be there. Plus other guests, lots of stuff going on besides Gargoyles, including a Spider-Man panel, a Young Justice panel. And of course, we're doing a live podcast of Voices from the Eerie from there. And we are with Greg and Jennifer, of course. And we are doing a radio play with Tom and Bridget and Zara all participating. So you have a chance to audition and then perform with actual actors, professional voice actors. And there's a pie contest, the Fancy Bastard Pie Contest, where Tom and Zara and I will be judging who can bake the best pie at a pop culture convention.
Nice.
Mostly because I just really, really
will do like anything pie. For some pie.
Right here for a moment, I thought it was the other pie that you were talking about, not, you know, the 3.14 pie, not the actual pie.
No, pie, like apple pie.
Nice.
Banana cream pie, you know.
Right.
Love it.
Much more fun than the numbers.
Yeah.
We need to figure out what that live podcast is going to be. Otherwise, I suspect Senek Belinsky and J.Lo Riel are going to be very upset with us.
Oh, boy. I wanted to say thank you to everyone who participated in my Kickstarter. It went amazing. I've got a lot of work to do. We're going to crank them out as fast as we can.
You've got this.
Thank you so much, everybody.
All right. And Mark, I want to thank you for coming on. Greg, thank you for always coming on. Jennifer, thank you for everything you do. I know I keep saying this, but I couldn't do this without you. And to our listeners, thank you. Without you, there is no show. And join us next time as we return to Scotland, to Loch Ness, for Monsters.
Thank you for listening to Voices from the Eerie, a Gargoyles podcast, powered by the Spidey Dude Radio Network, located at spidey-dude.com. If you like this show, then please listen to Spectacular Radio, based on the Spectacular Spider-Man animated series, which features some familiar voices. You can also find these great podcasts: Clone Saga Chronicles, Make Mine Mayday, Amazing Spider-Man Classics, the Sal Buscema Podcast, and Books of X. All of this and more on the Spidey Dude Radio Network. And please follow us on Twitter at From Eerie. That's From E-Y-R-I-E. And join us on Patreon at patreon.com/SpideyDudeNetwork for more exclusive content. Thank you.
Do I really need an excuse to have a good time in my own home?